Thank you for the food we're about to receive. In the Lord's name, amen.
Amen. A typical American family at dinner. Mom and Dad, their beautiful daughter-in-law, and their only son, Joe, a homicidal maniac.
Harry! What are you doing?
How's your dad?
It's okay.
There you go. Thanks a lot. What you hunting this time?
I'm gonna shoot some pigs.
Targets, a movie about a war inside a man's head.
Hey, what are you doing?
Peter Bogdanovich, the director of The Last Picture Show, takes you for a roller coaster ride through the canyons of a disturbed mind in Targets.
Get out the light! The light!
Stay in there, get down!
Oh, there's somebody shooting out here!
Open the window!
Blow your window down! There's a sniper in here!
What turns an all-American boy into an all-American killer?
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like. This is Mike Price, welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And folks, if you've been listening to the podcasts with any sort of regularity, you know that voice belongs to one of the great Renaissance men of our time, author of, most recently, The Gripes of Wraith, Michael H. Price. Michael, it's very good to be back with you to do another podcast.
Always a treat, man. Yes, what a treat.
Well, it is a treat, and I'll tell you, it was a treat to rediscover Targets for me. How about for you?
Oh, boy. That's a picture that never gets old.
No.
It's as progressive today in its thinking as it was when it was new. And, of course, a lot of people missed it when it was new because it kind of passed unnoticed.
Mm-hmm.
It did get Peter Bogdanovich, a niche directing The Last Picture Show.
Right. And I think was reissued after that Last Picture Show was such a hit. I think it had a mild reissue, didn't it?
Yes, they got a little mileage out of it from there. Should have been Boris Karloff's valedictory film, but he kept working anyway.
Right. And it really is when you think about it. I mean, we know we have the Jack Hill films after that, and some people love those. But that's about as good a farewell as you could do as a horror icon, what Boris Karloff did in Targets, I think.
I'm pretty big on valedictory films, especially those that gray eminence kind of fade off into the sunset with an emphatic gesture.
And I think Karloff knew it too, didn't he?
Targets was made right around the time that George Turner and I did that marathon career interview with Karloff.
Oh, yes. What was that for?
That was on behalf of the American Film Institute,
right,
which
sure.
had just been organized.
Mm-hmm.
Big old federal grant, kind of like, gosh, this felt like the WPA all over again.
Right.
And we're going to... what we were going to do with the Film Institute was just start chronicling these stories,
mm-hmm.
Not unlike work that I have done, you know, for the film archive at SMU or
right.
for the Institute of Texan Cultures.
Right.
But this was like very, very specifically geared to what at the time was threatening to become the forgotten history of the movie industry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the timing was right. I guess you could say the early work with the American Film Institute was the beginning of Forgotten Horrors.
Sure. And you worked with Karloff then, and you did a long interview with him.
Yeah. It was quite amazing. It was kind of, let's see, after Targets, but not long after.
Mm-hmm.
More around the time that he was doing his Hollywood insert shots for those Jack Hill Mexican films.
Right. Yeah, the four of them. Well, I'll tell you, it was such a wonderful way to go out, and Karloff must have known it because I did a little background research for this, and I understand that the reason it came along was because Karloff was still contracted for 2 days with Roger Corman. You know, now everybody talks about the Terror and how, well, once Karloff had done, I believe, The Raven, he had a few days left over, so not wanting to waste anything, they put him immediately in another film, Corman did, which really just had him going in and out of doors and looking at things, and it became The Terror. But I did not know that he had 2 days left on his contract with Corman when he did Targets. However, I did find out that although he was only supposed to be used for 2 days, and The Terror, the footage from The Terror in Targets was supposed to consume a lot more screen time, Karloff actually did 5 days of work in that picture and only charged Corman for two.
Sure.
Which made everybody happy.
He was a very generous fellow. His health was failing, of course, at this time. And that's why he shot his insert footage for the Jack Hill pictures, Isle of the Snake People, for example, in Hollywood, because his doctor wouldn't let him travel to Mexico.
And he was on oxygen, I believe, at that time, was he not?
Yeah. And the striking thing that he, many stories, but he explained, I want to die in harness.
and he just about did, didn't he?
what a graceful way to proceed onward.
Yes, it was. And what strikes me, because I saw the film when it first came out, in the 70s, and I didn't see it again until Joey and I watched it here a few weeks ago in preparation to do this podcast, and I am just stunned by how good that picture is, and also, as you alluded to earlier, it's timely as today's headlines. You see the young man, Tim O'Kelly's character, going in and looking at the array of weapons on his bed, and you think this is exactly what's going on today.
No, it was basically the Charles Whitman story.
Yes, yes.
Right around the same time, how did that go? Right around the same time, Joe Tex did one of his really serious social commentary records.
Oh, he did.
We think of Joe Tex as a funny man.
Sure,
and kind of a soul preacher,
dance kind of guy, sure.
But his accomplishment right around this same time as Targets was a song called "We're Killing Ourselves."
Oh no, I don't remember that.
And it's just harrowing. I mean, it's he uses that emphatic preacher voice that he used on like "Hold What You've Got," and ammunition is plentiful and the snipers are having themselves a field day.
Wow.
And it's like it's as serious and revealing of the times as Marvin Gaye's "What's Going On,"
right,
and a lot more fun.
Yes. Well, for those who don't know the synopsis, and we won't go into it deeply, except that basically two stories unfold at the same time. One is a story of a suburban family with a militaristic bent. And I didn't realize until I started doing the research that Tim O'Kelly's father in this picture was Lieutenant Rip Masters in the old Ren 10-10 series. Did you know that?
I didn't know it, not to think of it, but yeah.
Right. Now that you think of it, I was also in Dallas later on as a lawman. And so we have this unfolding with a troubled guy who loves guns and a suburban family. At the same time, we have Boris Karloff as an aging horror star who's decided he's just going to quit. And Peter Bogdanovich using his own name, but Sammy Michaels is his character, which is incidentally a tribute to Samuel Michael Fuller. Fuller, who helped him with the picture, uncredited quite a little bit. And the two threads of the story meet head on at a drive-in appearance that the Boris Karloff character does. And it is just brilliantly put together. A very, very threadbare picture, very low-budget picture. But Karloff gives so much gravitas to the role. It's just amazing what a presence he is on the screen.
That film also but very emphatically addresses the argument that horror in fiction is a valid way to loose one's demons in a creative way.
There goes back to the Aristotelian thing about the letting it all go, letting
creative and constructive manner, as opposed to the harrowing violence that is happening simultaneously in the real world outside this motion picture.
Yes.
And of course, Karloff, gosh, man, he looks like a guy who can take care of himself.
He has one line in that, Michael, that just gives me chills when I saw it and every time I think about it. And I don't want to spoil, we don't want to spoil the film for anyone who hasn't seen it, but when he says, "Is that what I was afraid of?"
Yeah.
What a wonderful, wonderful line. And it's just, and for those of us who love escapism and who loves the Aristotelian concept of catharsis and the idea of, Aristotle, of course, was talking about the tragedies in which everyone can, you know, take the baggage on of the heroes and then they die, but the audience goes on. It's just a wonderful picture in so many different ways. And, you know, I'm a Vietnam veteran. I own guns. I don't know if you do or not. I own a couple of guns.
Sure.
But I live in the country. But the idea of the gun culture is now, 50 years later, however long it is now from, or it's not 50, I guess 40 years later, is the crux of the conflict between the real and the fantasy, and the conflict, you know, the idea of owning guns as a right and all this sort of thing, and owning more guns than you need. I mean, it's all addressed there.
Very worthwhile story. Corman wanted a sensational picture.
Yes.
He got Bogdanovich, who had worked primarily as a film historian and critic up until this point, to work for chump change. Here's your tiny budget, kid. Go make me a picture about the tower sniper.
Right.
And Bogdanovich filled the order and then some by making it a polemic with the gun culture.
Yes, he did. Absolutely. Good way to put it. And hadn't he worked for Corman before that with Voyage to the Planet of Prehistoric Women? Didn't he shoot the Mamie Van Doren scenes on the beach at Laguna?
I believe that's right. And he realized, Bogdanovich realized, I've spoken with him extensively about this developmental period he had. He knew that the only way to develop a serious filmmaking career was to start at the most readily available level.
Which Corman was more than happy to let him do for, as you say, chump change.
Oh, yeah. And the generosity, in turn, of Corman had so little to do with money and so much to do with opportunity.
Right. That's absolutely right. Just being there and being willing to do whatever needed to be done. And I believe before this, he had done some uncredited work on The Wild Angels.
I believe that's
mistaken.
Right.
Yeah. But this is one of those things, and I was pleased also to see the references to Appointment in Samara. As a John O'Hara fan, now I know Appointment in Samara, the short story, was written by, gosh, I can't remember who it was now. It was a major writer. But John O'Hara used Appointment in Samara, the idea of fate running you down and not being able to escape, as the title of his first, and many people think his very best, book.
Once upon a time, many, many years ago, a rich merchant in Baghdad sent his servant to the marketplace to buy provisions. And after a while, the servant came back, white-faced and trembling, and said, "Master, when I was in the marketplace, I was jostled by a woman in the crowd, and I turned to look, and I saw that it was death that had jostled me. And she looked at me and made a threatening gesture. Oh, master, please lend me your horse that I may ride away from this city and escape my fate. I will ride to Samara, and death will not find me there." So the merchant loaned him the horse, and the servant mounted it and dug his spurs into its flank, and as fast as the horse could gallop, he rode towards Samara. Then the merchant went to the marketplace, and he saw Death standing in the crowd, and he said to her, "Why did you make a threatening gesture to my servant when you saw him this morning?" Death said, "I made no threatening gesture. That was only a start of surprise. I was astonished to see him here in Baghdad, for I have an appointment with him tonight in Samara."
Again, it's fate. It's fate that brought the Boris Karloff character and the Tim O'Kelly character together. And it just plays out so well. I mean, people love The Last Picture Show with good reason, and Paper Moon, and even Nickelodeon, and a lot of the things that Bogdanovich has done. But for my money, he's never been any better. It brings to mind the Andre Gide quote, where art is born of constraint and dies of freedom.
Yeah.
And isn't that, I mean, he was so constrained by a budget and a shooting schedule that was insane and not much money, and he made a picture like this.
Quite an accomplishment.
Yeah.
And I, as much as I I had to defy an order from Ben Johnson in order to see The Last Picture Show.
Yeah, he didn't like it because I made him cuss.
We were doing the King Kong interviews related to Mighty Joe Young with Ben Johnson,
right.
And George Turner and I were just sitting there just soaking it all in because Johnson was a great storyteller, you know, a real cowboy.
Sure he was. Oklahoma cowboy.
Yeah. And he says, and the topic, and George mentioned something about the imminent release of The Last Picture Show, and he said, That Bogdanovich boy bamboozled me into making that nasty picture. and I just want you all boys to do me a favor, so just don't ever go see that nasty picture.
Really? And yet he won an Academy Award with it.
And even after he won the Oscar for his work with Bogdanovich. Bogdanovich was friends with John Ford, and he prevailed upon Ford to persuade Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Even after Ben won the Academy Award, last time I talked to him was for a little picture he did with Bill Paxton called Back to Back.
Yes.
And he says, "I hope you honored my request never to see that nasty picture."
Well, I've got to tell you, my friend, Clu Gulager, was delighted to be in that picture. And he had no such compunctions at all about recommending it. He was very proud of his work in that picture. Another Oklahoma boy, just like Ben Johnson.
Right.
Well, all right. I want to say that Joey, our producer, found that this is a pretty pricey item on DVD, right, Joey?
Yes,
is that correct? Yes. And so if a person wants to see it, you're going to have to see it. How did we saw it streaming on Netflix? Is that right?
We rented it. Which is like you pay like a little fee to stream it from Amazon.
Okay, we streamed it from Amazon. So if you want to see it, that's probably how you're going to get it. Why do you suppose, Joey, why do you suppose the DVD is so expensive?
I have no idea if it's like a rights issue or something because of the music.
It's a limited edition.
Oh, it's a limited edition, yeah. Michael says.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
I'm hoping for a Criterion.
Yeah. We're hoping for, because it deserves to be much more widely seen than it's being seen right now. I think, Michael, I could say that you and I both heartily recommend this film.
Definitely. Absolutely. Wouldn't have it any other way.
Well, and you know, now it's come to the portion of the program where we want to plug some stuff, and you have been very busy with your comic book stuff. As well as your musical things. Would you let the listeners know what, if they enjoy the podcast, how they might want to support us in this Christmas season? And
oh, my golly.
For their friends?
Well, the new title, of course, is called The Gripes of Rape, mm-hmm. which is, yeah, it's the book is, in fact, subtitled with Apologies to John Steinbeck.
Would you explain The Gripes of Rape? Because that's a great, great story.
Oh, well, I've already blown the punchline, but that's okay, too. Mm-hmm. I was a school kid when I first met John Carradine, and another one of those cats like Karloff, who was just generous and very accepting and welcoming and did not condescend.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad and I met him by chance at a restaurant in eastern New Mexico while I was traveling with Dad on some of his company business. And we've spotted this character with the voice and the face a few booths down in this little short order joint, and that's him. Well, probably not. What would he be doing here? I said, I'm going to go ask him. Sure enough, it was John Carradine, and they invited us to join him at the table, and we talked about movies, and of course Dad was crazy about his work in anything, especially The Grapes of Wrath.
Right. What a wonderful job he did in that.
Preacher Casey.
Yeah.
And the great man immediately sensed my affinity for the spookers. I'll tell you, my boy, once we finish this Liberty Valance picture, I'm going to begin work on probably the most horrifying film I've ever done. And he builds it up and builds it up. It's about a ghost with a grudge against the entirety of humanity. And I said, well, gosh, Mr. Carradine, what's the name of this picture? And he says, we're going to call it The Gripes of Wraith. And it was like, the effect was rather like that of an old Depression-era comic strip where the character goes flying head over heels at the punchline.
So now you've given a tribute to Carradine with this new book that you've done.
Oh yeah. Well, the book itself is a collection of the 1940s ghost gallery stories from a magazine called Jumbo Comics.
Drew Murdoch's Ghost Gallery, right?
Yeah, Drew Murdoch Ghost Gallery. It's mm-hmm. amazing. It's Murdoch is like a hard boiled private eye who investigates hauntings.
Mm-hmm.
You might call him the ancestor of John Constantine.
Sure.
And so Craig Yeo and I just finished a new book for IDW Publishing called The Ghosts and Girls of Fiction House, which reprints a selection of these ghost gallery pieces. But meanwhile, I'm using a separate set of restorations, page restorations, in a completely different restoration style. And I figured, we've done all this work. Let's not let anything go to waste. And so we're doing the parallel series of the complete ghost gallery. This is volume one, and then there'll be volume two and volume three, and, mm-hmm. you know, however long it takes to exhaust the series, because mm-hmm. I have, thanks to some collector friends in Europe, Jim Vadeboncour especially,
uh-huh.
We've compiled a complete run of good high-resolution scans from Jumbo Comics. And once we finish the ghost galleries, I'll probably get started on a restoration of Will Eisner's Hawks of the Seas.
Well, I want to inject here that the books that you do under the Cremo Studios imprint are a little different.
7 or 8 years ago, I was working on some page restorations for a new publisher in New York that had asked for some horror comics. I said, well, gosh, how about some Iger shop? That is the Jerry Iger studio of the 50s, 40s and 50s, which did horror comics that make Tales from the Crypt look like the Ladies' Home Journal.
Oh, indeed, exactly.
Yeah. And I got to doing, got to working on these page restorations, that is, scanning the battered, yellowed comic books and then cleaning them up in Photoshop to where they would look much more like new, cleaning, correcting the color, correcting printer flaws, etc. And I got those good-looking restoration. Too bad the writing is so lousy. And, you know, I mean, the heroine sees this ghastly creature, and she says, eek, what a terrible monster. It's like, we can do better than that. So,
and you
one
did.
Thing, one thing leads to another, and the trick is to... you know, treat these ghastly old, sometimes like really badly written but nicely drawn comic book stories with the kind of absurdity that you would see in, well, either Samuel Beckett or the Three Stooges.
Or both.
And both,
in
exactly.
At the same time, yeah, the Three Stooges.
I mean, you know, the Three Stooges were doing Waiting for Godot before
exactly,
Sam Beckett ever...
Yeah. That's exactly what I was going to say. You're absolutely right. And so these are available on Amazon?
Yes, yes. Good representation of the series, of course, is called Comics from the Gone World, and that's the key word for the Amazon directory.
Well, I can't tell you how many laughs I've gotten out of them, and I'm looking forward. I just got Gripes of Wraith the past couple of days, and I'm really looking forward to cracking into that and having a big time with it. I want to say also that my own Hardboiled Christmas Stories is just in time for the holidays. We're bringing it back into the public consciousness, we hope. Joey is helping me with that as my social media director. And we've actually had some very good sales on Hardboiled Christmas Stories, which is pulp stories from the 30s and 40s, along with a new story written in the style of Robert Leslie Bellum's Dan Turner Hollywood Detective, the first new Dan Turner story in 60 years, which I wrote. And we also have a new book out called Homicide Highball from the folks down in Florida. Bold Venture Press asked if they could reprint the script that I wrote for the Dan Turner Hollywood Detective, the original script. Now, the movie's 25 years old. It was a made-for-TV movie featuring Mark Singer as Dan Turner. But the first time, they asked me for a contemporary setting. So in the script that's in the book, I have a heavy metal cab driver. I have a lot of things that changed when they decided to go back to doing a period piece.
Right.
So that's also out as well. And we would love for anyone that is looking for that looking for something that hard to buy for person on their list to look at Gripes of Wrath or Homicide Highball. And finally, Michael, I must say that we are hearing, we're so happy to hear from people on Facebook. We always want to know if there's a particular film you'd like for us to maybe put through the Forgotten Horrors podcast. We'd be glad to listen. And our friend Alice Goodson was at the OFCON in Norman, Oklahoma. OF standing for Oklahoma Alliance of Fans, which was a group I actually helped found back in 1967.
Yeah.
And Ellis came up and he said, you know, I'd really like for you guys to work on, well, I'm not going to give away the film, but he said, we'd like for you guys maybe to treat this film next time to the Forgotten Horrors podcast treatment. So we may be just doing that next time around.
I will look forward to that immeasurably. There are... Oh, there's always something new to be found about something old.
And you know, that's right. And I keep thinking about Robert Louis Stevenson's Child's Gardener verses. The world is so full of a number of things, I think we should all be as happy as kings. Michael, I'll catch you later on. Thanks a lot. Thanks, folks, for listening. We'll be back at you before you know it.
Mighty glad.